The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how whales get sunburns, too. Is this a new phenomenon, Dave?
Well, that's what researchers are trying to find out. Rob, over the past few years, marine biologists have noticed skin lesions on whales and dolphins and other cetaceans. And usually these lesions are the result of an infection, like a fungal infection. But one researcher wondered whether there might be something more going on. The lesions reminded her a little bit of what skin cancer looks like in people, and she was curious whether whales were getting sunburned and potentially skin cancer just like people do.
Were there prior studies to serve as controls here?
Well, Rob, there wasn't a control group per se, but the study was conducted over a three-year period. And what the researchers saw was that they noticed a lot more of these, what they call blisters, the number of blue whales especially, which have light skin, just like, you know, humans can have light skin. Whales have different skin color, and fairer humans tend to get more sunburns and sun cancer. Well, it turns out that blue whales, which are the fairest of the three whales the researchers studied, they studied blue whales, fin whales, which have dark skin, and sperm whales, which are sort of in the middle in terms of skin color.
And this increase is indicative of what?
Well, the researchers think that it has to do with a thin ozone layer. The ozone layer is a lot thinner than it used to be a few decades ago, and that's increased the amount of UV radiation that shines down on Earth. And that's why you and I, when it gets really bright outside, will reach for a t-shirt if we don't have a top on, or reach for that bottle of suntan lotion. Well, whales don't have that luxury. In the past, it may not have been as big of a problem because the UV radiation wasn't as high as it is now. But now you're talking about these creatures that have very large body sizes, spend a lot of time at the surface, and even when they're not at the surface, they're maybe just a few meters below the water, and even then they're still receiving the UV radiation. So there's a lot of concern that these creatures that are spending a lot of their lives in the sun are putting themselves at risk for sunburns and, more problematically, skin cancer.
Did researchers find any examples of skin cancer?
Well, they didn't find any examples of skin cancer. And the way they actually studied these whales is they took photographs, one, but they also shot darts into the whales. And this was harmless, but they were able to shoot these darts into the whales, pull the darts back, and the darts had these little skin samples. And they would, researchers would do a biopsy of the skin samples, just like you would do if you went to your dermatologist and he or she took out a hunk of your skin and looked at it. Well, these biologists took a look at these small chunks of whale skin, and they noticed a lot of things that they see in humans with skin damage, things like an increased production of microvesicles, the vesicles that are present in skin, an increase in the particles in skin cells that help repair damaged tissue, and more melanin. And melanin is what increases in our skin when we get tan, but it's also a sign that we're being overexposed to the sun. So they're seeing a lot of this evidence that the whale skin is becoming damaged by sun, but so far no evidence of skin cancer.
So another indication then of ozone depletion here, it sounds like.
That's what the researchers are speculating. They don't have solid evidence that this increase in skin damage is actually linked to ozone, but the timing seems about right. And what experts say is really important about the study is that researchers now have a tool to study skin cancer in whales, and now they have a data set that they can compare it to, so they can look over the next few years whether they're seeing more and more of these lesions in whales and whether any of these lesions are developing into cancer.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from our sun to the billions of suns out there in the universe, this next story is about giant balls of hundreds of thousands of tightly spaced stars known as globular clusters and how they formed.
Don't researchers already have hypotheses about how that happened?
Well, they do, and they've turned to one of their favorite culprits in the universe, which is dark matter. And Rob, dark matter is this mysterious, invisible substance that permeates the entire universe and is actually thought to make up most of the known universe, although we can't actually see it. And researchers have used dark matter to explain a variety of phenomena, like the shape of spiral galaxies, for example. And so in this case, researchers said, well, you've got this really tightly clumped ball of stars. And the thing about globular clusters is these stars are ancient. These are some of the first stars thought to have formed in the universe. So the question is, how did these stars clump together in the first place when you had this early universe where there wasn't a lot of things around? And the popular going theory is that there was a lot of dark matter around, and dark matter formed these halos that compressed gas and dust in the early universe, sparking star formation, and then the dark matter would have stuck around, keeping these stars sort of clumped together in these balls of thousands of stars.
And what are researchers saying now?
Well, researchers are saying, where's the dark matter? They looked at two of these globular clusters, one called NGC 2419, which is about 30,000 light years from the center of the Milky Way. Another one called MGC-1, which is located about 65,000 light years from the center of the nearby Andromeda Galaxy. And the reason they chose clusters so far out from the galactic centers is because they wanted to look at a cluster that looked like it did when the universe first began. And when you have these clusters that are far away from the galactic center, they're not as exposed to as many violent conditions. So if there was dark matter around billions of years ago, it should still be there. It shouldn't have been pulled away by, you know, some sort of bizarre activity happening closer to the galactic center. So these are what the researchers say are pristine globular clusters. They've really been untouched over time. But when they looked at these guys, they didn't see any evidence for dark matter. The idea is if there is dark matter holding these clusters together, holding these stars together in the cluster, then the cluster should be really tightly packed. But what the researchers saw is that the edges of these clusters, there were stars missing, as if they had sort of drifted away. And you wouldn't expect that if there was dark matter or a dark matter halo still there. So they conclude based on this that there was never any dark matter in the first place, because if it was there, if it used to be there, it should still be there, because these are pristine globular clusters.
Is this prompting researchers, astronomers, cosmologists to reconsider dark matter's role or even dark matter's existence in how these various structures like spiral galaxies come to look the way they do?
Well, the researchers don't go that far. They say just because we don't see dark matter here doesn't mean it's not anywhere. But what they do say is that we may have to rethink how at least globular clusters form, and we should look at a lot more of these clusters to find evidence of dark matter. So far, nobody's found any evidence of dark matter with the clusters that they've looked at. And so these studies seem to be poking holes in this theory that dark matter is really required for these clusters to form. But if that is the case, then you're right, Rob, then it could be that dark matter may not be important for a lot of the things that we thought in the universe. Although, again, the researchers aren't quite willing to go that far just on the basis of studying two globular clusters out of the probably thousands or millions or even billions of these clusters that are out there.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from how globular clusters evolved to how insects evolved, this last story is about how the insect brain has changed over time.
So looking at old ones trapped in amber or something like that?
Actually, no. What researchers did in this study was they looked at insects that resemble insects that lived millions of years ago. What they're basically trying to figure out is this whole idea of why social insects have such large brains. And it's not just that their brains are big, but they have these structures in them called mushroom bodies. And these are these mushroom-shaped, as you might expect, brain regions that are really important for processing and remembering smells and sights. Now, when I say social insects, we're talking about insects like ants and bees, insects that live in these really large, complex societies where there's a caste system and a lot of really intricate relationships with all the members. Researchers have long thought, okay, we're seeing these mushroom bodies in these social insects, and we've linked these mushroom bodies to sort of higher intelligence or at least higher cognitive processing. These insects must have evolved these mushroom bodies because they live in these really complex societies and they need a lot of brain processing power to deal with these societies. So that was the going hypothesis.
So there are examples of precursors of social insects that are around today?
Basically, the researchers in this study looked at wasps. And the idea with the evolution of an insect like a wasp is that the earliest wasps were probably plant eaters. And then over evolutionary time, some of them branched off and began becoming parasitic. They would lay their eggs in the larvae of other insects. And then even further along or more recently in evolutionary history, some of these parasitic insects would have branched off and would have become social insects, the type of wasps that live in these very complicated social colonies. And the neat thing is that even though this evolution has taken place over tens of millions of years, there still are around today wasps that only eat plants and wasps that are parasitic. So even though these aren't the exact same creatures that were around, say, 50 million, 100 million years ago, they have the same sort of lifestyle. So the idea is if we can look at them, we can study what the brains were like in these creatures that existed before social wasps came on the scene.
What were the brains like?
So what the researchers did was they compared the brains of plant-eating wasps to parasitic wasps, the wasps that lay their eggs in the larvae of other insects. And what they found was that the parasitic wasps had larger and more elaborate mushroom bodies than the non-parasites. In particular, the caps of these mushroom bodies were about twice the size in the parasitic wasps than in the plant-eating or the non-parasitic wasps. And this really throws a wrench into the theory that it was this transition from parasitism to being social that created these really large mushroom bodies. It looks like these mushroom bodies were already in place when at least these wasps were still engaged in a parasitic lifestyle.
In place, or was there further evolution when these insects became social?
Well, that's still an open question. It's possible that just because these parasitic insects had bigger mushroom bodies, the mushroom bodies could have gotten even bigger or maybe even more specialized and complex when the wasps became social. And that's going to require further study. But the bottom line conclusion here is that this idea that the insects could only become social once they developed these mushroom bodies seems wrong. It looks like they already had these mushroom bodies. So that may have been the big evolutionary leap from non-parasitism to parasitism versus from parasitism to social lifestyle.
Are there analogs in other species?
Well, dolphins also have very large and complicated brains, and they also have very complicated societies. And a lot of other mammals with large brains also live in these highly social societies. And so researchers see analogs between mammals and these insects. Now, whether this study in particular will translate into how we view mammalian brain evolution, probably not. There's too much difference between insects and mammals, but it just does cause us to rethink some of our hypotheses about how brains evolved, at least in this case, how insect brains evolved.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about the creature with the largest testicles on Earth, at least compared to its body size, and also a story about how cats lap up water. It turns out there's a lot of tricky physics involved. And on Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about how scientists want to count every single species on Earth. And also a story about Chinese science. Two prominent Chinese scientists have claimed that Chinese research is corrupt, and China's government has responded to this. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.